My name is Kira Kelly, and I'm here on the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Welcome back, Ben Rock.
To yourself as well, Ilya Friedman.
Hey, we've got a great episode today. We've got Kira Kelly returning and chatting all about the latest stuff that she's been working on.
And now, Close Focus.
What is our Close Focus today? What do we have to yak on about?
It's something that I have literally almost no interest in and never have. But it bears mentioning, and it definitely impacts the industry. And it's the Olympics and the way they're being presented this year on Peacock. Which, as you're listening to us, if you are a Peacock subscriber, you can go watch the Olympics. And they're doing something that brought. I actually think it is cool that they're finally doing something that could not have ever been done in any way on broadcast or cable television. Would you like to explain?
Yes, but I'm going to disagree. I think there was a way to do it. I just don't think there was an economical way to do it. They would have had to have had so many multiple teams in order to do it. And that is what they're doing, is they're doing AI recaps of sports in the day. And supposedly they're going to be using your personal view.
That's the part they couldn't have done. There's no way in hell until like right now that you could have done anything even remotely like that.
I disagree. I think that you could have had some sort of system look at your viewing preferences exactly like the way YouTube or Netflix does and say, oh, you watch this, we think you're going to watch that. And then they show you that. And then if they had hired actual broadcast journalists, people to cover these sports and things, you would have the actual, you know, the actual voiceover from the commentators going on versus this, which is going to be like auto-generating AI
commentating. AI Al Michaels, a very specific commentator who, if I knew anything about sports, I would probably know who he was. I'm sure he's awesome. AI Michaels, they're missing the opportunity. Maybe they aren't. But like, if you write AI, it looks like Al anyway. Al Michaels will be doing all the recaps for you, and in a sense what they're doing is they're just putting, you know, dozens of commentators out of work by using an AI to generate one voice for all the commentating. But the fact that yes on a Netflix like platform it could have tracked what you were watching, on broadcast it could never have done anything remotely approaching this. But what like, if you're a sports person, and I am not, you want to watch more fencing or whatever. I hear breakdancing is going to be in the Olympics. Is that true?
I didn't hear that, but that would be awesome if that's true.
I was talking to a friend of mine, and he was like, how can you judge breakdancing? I'm like, dressage, which is horse dancing, is in the Olympics. If you can judge a horse dancing, you can judge a human dancing.
Yeah, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, they've done plenty of other judged sports over the years. Of course, maybe the most popular and famous is like gymnastics, and in the Winter Games, something like ice skating. It's a panel of judges.
I think somebody has to sit there and count the pops and count the locks.
You know, there are already professional breakdancing competitions that exist around the world. So it does not surprise me that someone has brought this to the Olympics. I really hope that it's true.
You know what I would watch? I hope Peacock is listening to me. Dressage breakdancing. That's right. Horse breakdancing. I will watch horses breakdance.
I appreciate the mashup there, but, you know, it's really tough to get those painter's caps onto those.
get a horse to spin on its head.
Yeah.
Very much out of step with whatever modern breakdancing is, because I'm thinking about what it looked like when I was in the seventh grade.
Well, what I do think is particularly interesting and noteworthy and worth talking about with the Olympics in general is, though, that they're going to, they claim, put every medal, put every, you know, basically every event possible, everything onto Peacock. And this is something that I predicted in the earliest days of streaming, things like, you know, YouTube and whatnot, of, you know, old of old, I hate to use the word, the C word, but the old content, old stuff that from decades past would suddenly become in like this searchable database that people would be able to say, I want to look at the Olympics from, you know, 2000. I want to look at the Olympics from 1972. And I'm going to be able to find the sport and find what it is and be able to pull that up and be able to see or recapture that moment. That didn't exactly happen. The rights holders who had all that stuff did not say, you know what, we're making our entire back catalog searchable and available.
Although strangely, Nazi Germany did make Olympiad, the Leni Riefenstahl movie about the, what was it, the 1940 whatever Olympics. They made that. That's completely available. 36. It was the one where Jesse Owens beat everybody.
I'm pretty my sure
one,
that
that's your Ben Rock one sports fact that I actually know, and I don't I don't know what year it was. So
I think it was actually pre 1940, if I'm not mistaken.
That's what I said. I think it might have been 36 or something.
Yeah. Anyway, so the point is this though. What didn't really materialize for the back catalog, I think a lot of rights holders out there, studios, networks, whatnot, didn't see the value or didn't see like the potential revenue income for that. If they're shooting and doing stuff like this going forward, maybe there will be a shift. Maybe there will be a sea change, and that if you were to, you know, draw a line in the sand from here going forward, maybe we'll start to see all of that sort of like back catalog stuff. And for that person, especially a sports fan who says, hey, I want to watch, you know, the New York Giants play the, you know, Miami Dolphins from, you know, 2018. Let's pull this up. Maybe there's going to be the ability to do that.
I want to study the history of curling, the full history. Of people sweeping ice so that a puck moves faster. I totally don't get it. Anyway.
I think that there might be some streaming, like they haven't exactly figured out all the things that go into streaming services, but when that back catalog is AI indexable and you can command to Siri, you know, who won this or who did that, and I want to see it, and then they can pull from it and show and use it as a thing. I don't know. Maybe that's a maybe there is a you know, and look here. You know, I also predicted ages ago that Netflix, back in the era of when they had Max, I don't remember Max, but Max was their very, very crude AI system that was going to make predictions based on what you watched. Like, oh, hey, you watched
this. Seriously? That was a Netflix thing? I totally didn't. I've never heard of that.
So, Netflix had a thing called Max, which had like a very dramatic voiceover, and it was like, oh, well, you watched this, so you must like that. And almost every time I'll say that I used it, it was terrible. But there was one thing that they got absolutely right, and I believe we talked about it on the show, which was Luther. It recommended Luther, and I was like, holy crap, Luther was great. But I also had the suspicion that maybe they were just recommending Luther to everyone. So maybe because it was so... Yeah. So
you have a pulse. Maybe you'll like this.
I kind of have the feeling that as the AI host... sort of becomes a thing, and if it's successful here on Peacock, maybe we'll see more of this. They'll be less reliant on trying to make the AI a familiar voice or face, and more like a fully fleshed out character. And maybe you'll have a pick of who you want to be your virtual commentator for whatever it is. And if you particularly like a particular style or announcer, it's going to be like,
or language, any language,
like, yes, or language, yeah. Picking the voice on your Waze navigation or picking the voice on your Google navigation. I have a feeling that you may be able to do that with your commentators and have a somewhat different experience because they know what your preferences are. And if you like lots of profanity in your commentary, maybe you'll get profanity.
Okay, that could get me watching some sports. You know,
yes, I mean, if you want snark in your commentary, maybe you'll get more snark. I mean,
I want Sarah Silverman. I'll watch sports if Sarah Silverman does all the commentary.
Yeah, you know, that might be a thing, although I have a feeling that's still very, very, very far away.
Well, can I say that? I mean, like, yeah. I haven't heard the AI Michaels. I'm going to keep working on that. I'm going to make that happen. That's going to be my fetch. I haven't heard AI Michaels, but what I've noticed is the preponderance now of AI voice work on radio commercials, podcast commercials, on YouTube stuff that is narrated. And the more it sounds like it's the uncanny valley thing, the more it sounds like a real person, the creepier it gets. It's like, mm-hmm. It's missing something. And this is always the case when we try and simulate real humans. And you know, the thing that you're not going to get with AI commentary is the again, as not a sports fan, but the genuine surprise when somebody does something shocking and different, and you know, exceeds your expectations or fails spectacularly or whatever that is. You're not going to have like a human reaction to it. You're gonna have, you know, bleep blorp and so and so went 25 feet further than we thought, bleep blorp.
That's exactly right. And as much as this may become a thing, I think I'm going to argue for it never becoming a thing, at least not really, because ultimately, certainly in the short run, and by short run I mean the next 10 years, 15 years, it's gonna suck. It's gonna be worse than having, it's gonna be what much worse than having a human do it. So, you know, as much as people love to say, oh, this is the worst it's ever going to be, it's totally unacceptable for most things, I would say right now. And it'll be interesting to see what happens with Peacock. I almost assuredly think that depending on how much they rely on AI Michaels, that it is a, it's going to fail. It's going to fail in some regards, not because there'll be profanity, but because there is something that is monumental and the AI does not actually give it the appropriate gravitas in the moment.
Yeah. I mean, it's just not going to be human.
Yes. And let me tell you, there might be the opposite too, where there's way too much gravitas given for something.
But that is I would say like for transitional stuff where it's like, hey, coming up next, blah, 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 blah. Who cares? Great. AI Michaels, take it away. You know?
Like, yeah. And maybe that's what it'll be.
Maybe.
So we'll see. It'll be very interesting. But by the time that this episode is, so we're recording this before the functionality has gone live on Peacock. By the time you hear it in a week from now, it will have been live for a week, about, because I think it goes.
So the next time we can record, I will even go on Peacock and watch some sporting events of some kind. Ugh. And and I'll report my opinion of it if you do the same.
Well, you know, I do know that skateboarding is in the Olympics, and skateboarding was in the last Olympics as well, too. So you could watch some skateboarding. That might be something you're into.
Yeah, I could.
Even if they don't have breakdancing.
I hope they have breakdancing. I will say, as a final thing, I found out because the 2028 Olympics are going to be in my hometown of L.A. And
sure,
the skateboarding competition is going to be like 5 minutes from where I live. And I'm already like, how do I keep anyone from parking on my street?
Where is the skateboarding?
They're going to be doing a bunch of stuff at the Sepulveda Dam.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Not too shabby.
So all my stalkers who listen to this, you can triangulate where I live. I'm very close to the Sepulveda Dam.
Perfect.
Which, by the way, is in more cinematic news, is where they shot the ending of Buckaroo Banzai and many scenes from Escape from New York, in addition to lots of other stuff. And the music video, it was the music video for, oh crap, it was a They Might Be Giants music video they shot there. I forget what song.
It was also the first public vaccination site in the San Fernando Valley, so where you could go get vaxxed.
The Sepulveda Dam? You sure you're not thinking of Hanson Dam?
Oh shit, maybe it was Hanson Dam. You're right. You're right.
Get your damn straight.
Damn it. You're right. I was thinking of Hanson Dam. Mm,
there's nowhere to
Sepulveda Dam. I've been to several times.
There's nowhere to park really at Sepulveda Dam. So
that's true. You kind of have to walk out there. So that'll be fun. Oh, I know there'll be a cool background too for the skateboarding if they decide to actually use the dam.
I think they will. All right. So let's go ahead and move on to your interview with Kira Kelly.
Let's do it.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
I'm joined now by Kira Kelly, ASC, returning to the Cinematography Podcast over, I think it was probably about 4 years ago last time we chatted. So not much has happened in the last 4 years. Oh. I think there was a pandemic that took place. And then you became a member of the ASC. You did a whole bunch of like really cool shows. Kira Kelly, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Scott. I'm glad to be here and see you again.
I really am too. You know, I've been following your career with interest over the last few years. Of course, I think in March of 2020, no one knew at all what the world was going to look like, and clearly, you know, for many people out there, it was an incredibly trying time. But also, for many people out there, it did sort of like blossom and change. And you know, I know several people who had pretty incredible, you know, career shifts that happened during the pandemic into today. I think I might put you as one of those people. You know, hey, congratulations on becoming a member of the ASC. Give me your entire life story since March of 2020. Go. No, I'm kidding. give me a couple of highlights. I mean, I know you, I mean, we're going to talk about Echo. It's the new Marvel series for Disney Plus that you've been working on. But let's just step back a little bit. Since March of 2020, what's been going on with you?
Well, a lot has happened. Yes, I think globally and also personally. And for me, like March of 2020, so I was starting prep on this job in Toronto called Why the Last Man. And I got there on a Monday and we were all, you know, excited. I moved into my house. You know, of course, we started hearing about COVID and just like, okay, what is this thing? But, you know, we're all working. Nothing really shuts anything down. I remember of that same week on Wednesday, Tom Hanks got COVID, not on my job, totally unrelated. Mm-hmm. But once Tom Hanks got it on Wednesday, on Friday, production had me on a flight back to LA and home. I left so much stuff in the Toronto house, which in hindsight, I was like, yeah, we'll be back in like 2 weeks. It should be fine, you know? And suddenly it was not 2 weeks. I was, you know, home. And I mean, I find myself in a very privileged position, whereas like it was, you know, it was one of those times where I was like suddenly was able to stop and be with my family and be home and not have like the usual gremlins of like, why am I not working? Where's work? What am I doing? You know, because we were all kind of in that position. And so I was able to, you know, I did the same amount of like baking and cooking that everybody did. I was lucky in that the job that I was prepping, we kind of like, you know, me and then my alternating DP, Catherine Lutz, and then the costume designer, production designer, and all the showrunner and producers, we all kind of stayed really close. Mm-hmm. And we ended up doing this like weekly film watch that we would get together on Zoom and talk. So we were really able to like, Why the Last Man is a show about like a bit of an apocalypse, basically, where basically everybody with a Y chromosome dies, mm-hmm. right? And so mm-hmm. it's like this world is left to, you know, to kind of start over. But what was cool is that we were kind of making it within this frame of this time, which was super weird and interesting, but like kind of gave us a lot of insights. And so when we did go back to, Canada opened up a little sooner than the States. And so I was able to go back, I think in August or September, and I took my family with me and we were able to like, you know, you had to do like the 2 week, quarantine. So it was nice to be able to be like, okay, guys, we're all going to Toronto, or felt a little safer at a point. And then kind of start the show with like a lot of different insights. It was definitely a crazy time, I think for all of us, but, and then during that year in October, pre-October, I was invited to, you know, be a part of the ASC. And so it became news in October of that year, which was,
it's a big honor.
It's like one of,
yeah,
it's a huge, huge honor. And it's one of those things where you, I think I always kind of kept it as this, I don't even want to think about it. I don't want to dream about it. And then when it does happen, it's really kind of touching and a culmination of so much work and, means so much, you know, and I really, it's been wonderful.
Yeah. It's definitely, I think it's an adjustment for a lot of people too, because, suddenly you're kind of like at the cool kids table in a lot of ways. It's like, you know, I will say the ASC does a good job at fostering that sort of thing too. Cause it's like, they have lots of events. They try to bring in the membership and get them to talk about their projects. They try to do, you know, sort of like media and social media sort of stuff and educational. I myself, you know, sit on the tech committees and do tech committee stuff for them. And there's all kinds of things. Like if you want to be involved with the ASC, they create tons and tons of opportunities, but at the same time, a lot of the membership, the active members, are so busy that it's like they almost never get to do that stuff. And it makes sense too, of course, because people disappear and they travel and they go all over. But just since October of 2021, then, Have you noticed that having those three letters after your name, people take your calls or listen to you more? Like, is there been any sort of like intangible benefits to being part of the club?
I think that for me personally, it's like, I think I've always had a history of being very shy about asking for help or opinions or things like that. Like, oh, I'm working on this project. Like, how did you handle that when you did something similar? And when I joined the ASC, it kind of like, there was this opening of like, you know, people that I've looked up to for, you know, decades, like, you know, coming to me like, oh, how'd you handle that? Or I saw you did this thing. Or, and I was like, you're asking me. So it kind of made this like much a symbol and much more of like, you know, it's okay really to reach out for help and ask opinions and all this stuff, which I hadn't really given myself permission to do before. So that's been pretty lovely. And I love the fact that the ASC, you know, does so much with mentoring. And like, you know, each year I've been a member, I've been able to have like mentees of my own who, you know, I'm able to talk to, and feel like a lot of my peers and, you know, are becoming more members of ASC and like active members. So it's always great to see them. And I don't think it takes away still some of the, I've told this story to a friend, but like I was just in Albuquerque working on this job, and I was at this restaurant there, and Darius Kanji walks in. Mm-hmm. I was eating by myself, as DPs do on location. He walked in and was like talking to somebody that he knew at the end of the bar. And I was just like, oh my gosh, it's Darius Kanji. It's like, I can go and say hello and everything. And I didn't say, I chickened out so much of like this, like, you know, he's like, Darius was very formative, his work in my decision to be a DP. So even though I'm ASC, I couldn't bring myself to say hello, but maybe next time.
A moment of being starstruck. Well, you know what?
Yes,
you'll have tons more opportunities, I predict, as well. So, hey, yeah. I want to get into talking about your new Disney Plus series, Echo. Echo, of course, based on a comic book, and it is a limited series. I guess I would call it a spinoff almost of Hawkeye, if that's fair. And I noticed that it's been emblazoned with Marvel Spotlight. I don't know what Spotlight means. I was hoping that maybe you would know since you shot it. But
I think a lot of people, sometimes their entry into Marvel is thinking, well, I haven't seen every Avengers, or I haven't seen all the Iron Man, and like, so I'm going to be lost if I try to pick up this story. I think that the focus of Spotlight is stories that like you as an audience member can just jump into without having seen, you know, every MCU movie.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, because I watched the whole series and I have not watched every Marvel movie that's come before. And I gotta say that I picked it up no problem. And I did watch Hawkeye, which I think maybe helped a tiny bit, but not really, because I mean, we kind of get like a whole, you know, recounting of essentially where the spinoff happens in the first episode of the show. And I gotta say, the first episode or two, I'm gonna say the first like 90 minutes, there is so much going on. There is so much going on. You've got sort of like this, this sort of fantasy pre-time sort of world, this 1200 AD sort of like, you know, Mesoamerican, early American. Then you've got, sort of this modern day world, which encompasses sort of like a flashback from like a decade plus prior, and then modern day. I got to ask, when you got the show Bible for this, when you got the scripts for this, is it daunting to look at all the different like set pieces and things? Or is it, what happens after you look at just all the massive period of time and stuff that's going on in the first like 90 minutes of the show?
Yeah, I think that to a certain degree, it is a little daunting. You're just like, wow, how do you span all this? And I think to, you know, very much so of like the stuff, the things that happened outside of any timeline, like it was, you know, what starts the pilot is the creation myth of the Choctaw people, which had never been shown before, ever. And like, so that was kind of like this, you know, it was something that Sydney Freeland, our director, was very much in touch with the Choctaw Nation about, like, you know, presenting this, and this is what we want to show and how we want to go about showing this, and making sure that we did it in a very respectful way and a way that was authentic to them. And so that was something where it's kind of like you realize this privilege of being able to be part of that visual storytelling is not something that you get to do every day. So I think it's just like, you know, when you encounter all that information and seeing like how you're going to shoot it, it's definitely easy to get overwhelmed. But I think it's just like you kind of take it, you know, okay, scene by scene, like how, what does this scene mean? And what, why is this scene important to this character? And I think once you kind of start trying to get a little bit more focused in like that, it can make it a little less daunting. But yeah, we definitely covered a lot of ground. And I think the big challenge is also just visually making sure that the audience is able to follow all those different, you know, all the different timelines and things like that. So
yeah, and I think you do, yeah. I think you do a really good job. And it's a pretty consistent look, although with some different sort of interesting bits of spice kind of like thrown into this. I definitely feel like it's a, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but it looks like an anamorphic show. It looks mm-hmm. like at some point you brought in infrared. It like, mm-hmm. there's all these sort of like different sort of like visual. Can you talk a little bit about the idea of breaking down the visual approach to these different, like, you know, set pieces, to these different worlds and how they kind of fit together?
Yeah, we wanted to make sure that the ancestors stories, you know, did have a bit of a different feel. Like when we approached Maya's everyday world, you know, in New York, there was a certain level of grit. You know, when we got to the Oklahoma parts, we wanted to, like, you know, kind of embrace a little bit more of, like, you know, showing the greenery and, you know, still have a bit of the same grit, but maybe a lot more color. Actually, Sydney really loves color and wanted saturation to be a part of that Oklahoma story, like this mm-hmm. idea of going back home. Whereas the New York stuff still has color, but is a little bit more desaturated. So we really wanted the ancestral beats to kind of be very different. And so it was like, you know, how do you show the dawn of time? Or like, how do you show what they, like, stickball looked like with, like, you know, this pristine air that had never been polluted and water, and like really sort of show that crispness. And for that, we ended up, the show is a spirit anamorphic show, but for that one sequence, that with the stickball sequence, we shot spherical, and we shot like everything either on a 12 or a 20 mil. So everything was like very close, and our Steadicam operator was like in there and, like, you know, with the movement and with the, you know, stunt performers to actually try to get the camera as close as possible. The infrared sequence was shot that was episode 3. So that was shot by Magdalena Gorka and directed by Kat. And so they had this great idea of, like, you know, it was scripted as being black and white and found movie footage. But Magdalena had this great idea of, like, doing black and white infrared and really sort of making it feel very different there and having the trees pop and to a really beautiful effect. Yeah, it's just kind of like we really looked at each one and trying to figure out, like, what, you know, what each of those ancestors brought visually to Maya and her storytelling.
Lots of different locations, it sounds like, too, between New York and Oklahoma. But I know that also Marvel is big in Georgia and Atlanta. Did New York and Oklahoma all get faked in Atlanta? Was that? Yeah, I was gonna say
we shot in Atlanta. Yeah. Well, we shot, you know, the studio is about an hour south of Atlanta, and, you know, even about 45 minutes south of that is where we found a lot of the greenery and a lot of our locations for Oklahoma. And, you know, we could find some of the New York stuff. We were able to find some really great, you know, old buildings, like for the Daredevil fight and all that, like, you know, that we were able to really sort of match in.
You know, Kira, I want to talk about lighting a little bit, because you more so than a lot of, I would say, sort of, you know, contemporary DPs of your generation, I feel like really tend to focus on environmental lighting, reflective lighting, stuff that's going on mm-hmm. on your you know, your keys and your fills really much feels like they are part of the environment. They don't feel lit. And I've always uh-huh. really appreciated that about your work. And I'm wondering what's your thought process when you, and some of the set pieces that you have all these really complicated, like, environmental lighting going on, and it feels like the environment is lighting the person. Now, granted, you make the people look great, and I feel like there's always that balance, because if you just let the environment light someone, they're not necessarily gonna look their best. So how do you walk that line? How do you let the environment light your subjects and also keep them looking great?
Thank you. That's a big compliment. I appreciate it. I I try to focus on with lighting. I guess I should say I love lighting. And I'm kind of like, I try to sometimes simplify it more, sometimes make myself like focus on, you know, I don't know. I think there was a point in my career when I was first lighting where I was just like, oh, this is so much fun. And but suddenly you create this path where an actor can only get into one spot, and suddenly the only freedom they have to move around is about 2 feet around their mark. And yeah, great. The lighting looks great, but it's also you're very much like, you know, boxing them in.
Yeah.
And so I think for me, what I've been trying to and continue to try to finesse is this idea that, you know, the set, once I give it over to, like, once you call for first team, once it's time for the actors to come in, this feeling that the set then becomes theirs. Mm-hmm. And so what I try to do is, you know, of course, like, you know, it's a little easier on the wides and like the medium shots that, like, you know, you light as much as you can from the window. If there's no window, maybe there's something from above, or you try to like figure out a way that there's a little bit more movement for them. But even now when I go in for close-ups, I try not to then bring out the rest of the truck and do like, you know, do tighter things, but really just try to realize like, okay, what do I need? Or maybe that this actor needs this definite like bit of light for them, or this one doesn't need it as much. Or, you know, I really try to make it as minimal as possible, because what can happen is that time-wise, whether it's a movie or a show, like time is huge. And like, you can't, once you have the wide shot lit, you can't spend another hour lighting every close up. So trying to figure out how I can do as many of the big broad strokes as possible in the wide. And then so once I get to the close up, it's just a little bit more of finessing. And also I would say it's like, it's a huge, you know, huge thing to do with the relationship that you have with the production designer and prep. Like really talking out, like, you know, once sets are being built and planned, like where are the windows? Or would it make such a difference if we're building this set, if there was a window on this wall instead of on this one, or really sort of like playing with that idea. And then working with like the set decorators of like, this is the type of window covering I like, or this one has like, you know, like this type of lampshade that I like, and really being very intentional and prep about crafting it for what can kind of set you up for success later.
The counterbalance in some scenes that have, like, for example, in Echo, where you've got Maya and Fisk, you know, face to face or in a thing, but Maya is in, you know, they both clearly are in the same environmental lighting, but what's happening on Maya is very different than what's happening on Fisk. And I got to say that, you know, Vincent D'Onofrio, what a spectacular actor to be playing with this too. And he's got all this makeup effects too, giving nothing away. You know, he's gets this horrible wound in his head, you know, very early on. And yeah. I got to say that quite often I felt like, you know, the camera, first of all, just, you know, it loves both of them, but it really loves Vincent D'Onofrio and sort of like his countenance and just how, like, you know, imposing of a character and figure. Can you talk a little bit just about how you went about the juxtaposition of Maya, who is at some points an anti-hero, at some points she's a villain, mm-hmm. and then of course she does become a hero later on. But just talk about a little bit how you're visually changing the treatment of these characters in light.
With Fisk, it was one of those great opportunities where, you know, this is kind of similar with Why the Last Man. It was something where it's based on a graphic novel. And so it's like you have, you know, a whole run, years worth run of like images of like what these characters look like. And it's not to say that you like, you know, you directly pull from them, but it's like with Kingpin and with Fisk, you have all this like iconic imagery of him throughout Marvel Comics. And so that was something that I really kind of looked at and studied of just like, okay, how is he depicted in the comics? And then also like, how can we kind of translate that with lighting? And, you know, yes, there is an eye injury, and we kind of wanted to play with this idea of like, I remember with the scene in the kitchen, it's like, as he takes off the bandage and reveals it, this fine line of like, showing it, but then also leaving a little bit to the imagination and kind of like just showing the effects of it. And, you know, with all of his, like, you know, the suit and like what he's got under the suit, the, you know, he's a little bit more round, and especially with like, you know, the you know, the head, the bald head and everything. And so what I loved being able to do is really like play with some sidey lighting that had a lot of fall off, that was really like single source, where you kind of like, the whole relationship between Fisk and Maya is all about the two of them. There is genuine care between the two of them, but it's like the both of them like trying to outmaneuver the other. So you can never tell, or trying to lead the audience in a way where they don't know when to trust him. Like, you know, I generally believe that Fisk does care about Maya, but it doesn't change the fact that he tried to kill her, or she tried to kill him. Like, the whole thing, I'm like, there's this like weird love. But like, I liked the idea of being able to play with those shadows and kind of always calling into question their intentions. And especially like, you know, in the beginning when we, you know, show the two of them in New York having their, you know, their meals together, like he's teaching her and like teaching her all this stuff, and she's young and impressionable. And so really kind of like trying to show that, and like, you know, she's learning, eager to learn all this stuff about how to be a crime boss, you know? But then by the time when they get to Oklahoma, they're having more of these like, you know, sit down talks. The mistrust is something that I think that the shadow play really helps with.
Is there a favorite shot or sequence from, you know, Echo? Echo is, you know, it's 5 hours of television. It's like, you know, it's a lot more final product than a lot of features. Is there something that really stood out to you? It's just like a moment or a particular shot that really that you know was your favorite?
I have so many. Like I really love the Daredevil fight at the beginning. I love how we were able to keep, like, for Sydney, a big thing for her and that whole fight was like, you know, she was very clear that she wanted to do a one-er, you know, but she, I think what's so great about her is that she didn't want to just do a one-er to be cool and do a one-er and do a fight scene because it was cool to do one. Yeah. Her goal was like, we have to see her come, like Maya, we have to see Maya come into the scene as like a troubled, you know, bratty, sometimes, you know, like mischievous teenager, and leave as a killer, and leave as an anti-hero, and leave as like, you know, and that happens, what, I think the scene is like 3 to 4 minutes or something. It was really like her goal of like, yes, let's make it cool, let's do all this stuff, but that story needs to be told. And I think that like for me, it's just like at one point where, you know, she's like holding this guy's neck, and then like you hear the two of their heartbeats, like the sound design that they did on the show was so incredible. But at first you hear like two heartbeats out of sync, and then the heartbeats sync up, and then suddenly it's like you hear this crack and there's only one heartbeat. It's
That's
just like,
right.
that is the whole story right there. And so that was fun. That was fun for that. And then I also
wondered
just
if you
loved...
were going to mention that. I wondered because yeah. It is like it gives the impression that it's a very long one-er. It's in episode one. I believe it's episode one. And it's yeah. like... I think there's probably 4 or 5 hidden cuts in there somewhere, but the effect on the audience is like holy crap, we're still going with the Steadicam, we're still going with yeah. the shot, and it turns from like sort of like right before, you know, something bad's going to happen to this action sequence that goes on and on and on. How much time did this take? I mean, I got, even with the hidden cuts there, I got to imagine that was a lot to choreograph, a lot to get done.
It was a lot to get done. It was over multiple days. It was multiple units because there were some that was main unit. There was some that was second
I'm
unit.
Sure.
A lot of second
yeah.
unit with our really incredible like stunts team. And it was like, it was great in that, like, you know, we really had to, that was for me, one of the greatest things was, you know, Echo was one of my first, experience with doing that much second unit. Cause usually on my other projects, like when we had a big set piece, everybody would just do it. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a second unit. And so this was really fun in that it was fun, but also a little just like, what do you mean I don't get to be there the whole time? But it was really wonderful. I had this great second unit DP named Nicolas Aguilar. And like I sat and I made all the lighting plans of how I wanted to look. Mm-hmm. And then Sydney had all of her plans for where she wanted the cuts and the action to happen. So I was able to sit with Nico and really kind of go through, and you know, we were able to shoot all this stuff with Alakwa and then come through. And yeah, it was that sequence was so much organization of just trying to make it all happen and feel seamless. And so whenever I see it, I'm like, wow, it happened. It really worked. So another big sequence that I loved is in the last episode, which is the powwow. Like, so we October of 2021, we went, me and Sydney, Chris Trujillo, the production designer, and some of the other producers went to Oklahoma to the Choctaw powwow. Just to be able to, I had never experienced, like, Sydney grew up within powwows, obviously, and, like, you know, was very much, knew everything about it, but she knew how important it was for us to be able to go and experience it and really, you know, see what it is. And so what, when we got to the point where we were shooting hours, it was like, that was also over, you know, multiple days, and it was at night, and it was this huge, huge span. And we had people from all over the country coming with their regalia and, like, all the beautiful costumes and all this stuff. And it was one of the most emotional, times to shoot. It was like a really emotional sequence because we kind of got to be a part of this, part of this thing that, you know, not many people who aren't Native American get to experience. And it was like, we had, like, created this space for it. And, like, it was so nice to have, like, the, you know, people who are part of it come up and be like, this is, like, a real powwow. You guys created a powwow. And so that was, like, something that was really visually fulfilling and a great challenge. Like, it was a really great challenge.
Sydney is Sydney Freeland, who's the director of the majority of the episodes for Echo. Yeah. And of course, she also did Reservation Dogs and some other stuff out there. But all right. So Kira, I got to ask you, changing gears a little bit here. Do you know what's next for you? Can you talk about what's next for you? Do you have a project in development right now? What's going on with you?
Well, right now, well, Sydney and I, after we did Echo, we did this movie together called Res Ball. Mm-hmm. And we went and shot on the Navajo Reservation in New Mexico, Shiprock. And so that's coming out in the fall, which is exciting.
Yeah.
It's a Netflix movie. And then I also just finished shooting a movie about 3 weeks ago. That was in Albuquerque again. And that was like this, it's a movie for Monkey Paw Productions, which I'm really excited about.
That's it.
I don't think that's going to come out until like 2025. So that'll be a little bit of time.
Of course.
But I'm Monkey excited because we're doing
Jordan Peele, right? Jordan Peele's company, right? Monkey Paw?
Yes. So, yes. Yeah. Jordan was the producer on it. The director was this great Justin Tipping. And it was a really fun experience. So I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what comes up next. And yeah, that's where, you know, we're looking
at. That's super exciting.
yeah.
All right. Is there a genre? You've done a wide variety of stuff. And I would say now also adding like superhero Marvel stuff into the mix. Is there a genre you haven't worked in yet that you'd like to sink your teeth into?
Well, it's interesting. Like my last two movies, both Res Ball and Him for Monkey Paw have been sports movies. Like one was basketball, one was football. The Him has a little bit of psychological horror in it, like a thriller. I do love the like kind of end of the world stories. I don't know why, like the post-apocalyptic things where things are kind of starting over. Like why was such a great, fit for that. But I'm also just like a sucker for, I do like, you know, the non-genre things, the things that are just like, you know, a great story of like two people in a room and talking about their feelings.
I
love that too. But the action stuff was really fulfilling, I think more than I expected. Like I kind of just loved it and loved like what was fun in the research. And now it's like, you go and see movies and you're just like, I just saw Fall Guy, which was great. And like, you go and like see all this amazing stunts work and you're like, oh, I want to do that again. So I don't know. It's like, I think it goes back to Sydney's goal for Echo and for that Warner of like anything that is done well and is done in a way that promotes the story. That is where, you know, whether or not it's like a fight scene or like a building on fire or anything, or just again, two people in a room, if it's something where like promotes like just the story being told and visually, that's where I want to be. So
I think that is an awesome place to leave it. Kira, I'm really glad that we were able to make this happen. Thanks much for coming back on. And I can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We'll be right back. All right, so that was Kira Kelly. Kira, great seeing you again. I'm so glad that we had the opportunity to sit down and chat for a few more minutes. So, Ben, guess what time it is?
What time would that be?
It is time to pay the bills. We got to thank our fine friends over at Aerie, makers of all kinds of incredible cameras and lights and camera accessories. In fact, we got to talk about one of their latest camera accessories, which is getting some buzz right now, which is the Aerie Hi5 SX. And what makes the SX interesting is that you can get into it for a much lower price point than the Aerie Hi5. It's a single channel unit, but the hand controller gives you a slide, gives you a wheel, gives you, you know, all the functions that you were expecting from the full-blown Hi5. But it uses a software licensing system so that you pay less upfront. And then when you are ready to unlock some of those functionalities, you can do that remotely. So in the same way that I know that Tesla is doing it with some of their cars, you can unlock certain features if you pay a fee. They're doing it with the Hi5 SX. So for those who wanted to get into an Aerie remote focus system, but maybe didn't want to spring for the full cost up front and thought, well, you know, maybe I'll get to this at some point where I need these multi-axis or I need these different things, there is now an upgrade path. It's exactly the same build quality as their high-end system, but essentially gives people the ability to start off with a pro-level piece of kit at a much lower price. Of course, the Aerie Hi5 SX is available at Hot Rod Cameras, and you're going to start seeing it come out into the world here shortly. So if you are in the market, if you're a first AC, or if you regularly utilize remote focus Iris or Zoom systems, take a look at the Aerie Hi5 SX.
Do people who use it give each other high fives a lot?
You absolutely can. There's nothing stopping you from that. What I think would be very cool is if you high five two high fives. That would be
You don't want to do it too hard because you don't want to.
No. But a high five doesn't have to be a hard thing. It can just be
a little a tap. But real high five. Like if you ask my son, my son for a high five, you're going home with a bruise on your hand. Like,
well, he's of that age where he's got to you know, show his dominance. He's six, right?
Yeah. He's six. So yes.
Yeah. Six. Okay.
And now short ends.
So Ben, it is our short end time of the show where we talk about our pet obsession of the week. What is your short end?
My short end is actually a friend of both of ours, and we mentioned him on the podcast recently, and we didn't both know that we both knew him.
That's right.
he is a fella named Toby Wilkins, and Toby Wilkins is a great filmmaker, but I want to talk about this funky, cool side project he's working on, and maybe one day we'll have him on the show to talk about it. So a few years ago, he moved to Portland, where you are, and he's been tinkering, as far as I can tell, with 3D printing old cameras and cool optics. And if you go to his Instagram, which is just Toby Wilkins, T-O-B-Y-W-I-L-K-I-N-S, watch his reels. So what's Toby doing? He's taking like old Polaroid cameras and gutting them or pulling stuff out of them. And then I think 3D printing new parts that will allow you to like slide an iPhone into it. So you can use the iPhone camera on the old optics and get still images or video images using all of these old cameras. And he spun it out into kind of a boutique business that I don't think he's ready to go like super big. He's got a website which you can go to called ObscuraFlex. And on ObscuraFlex, he's going to be selling these parts that you can add onto these cameras, slide your iPhone camera or similar into it, and use the old body optics. You know, it's not the same exactly as a ground glass. He explained it to me once, but it's a little bit like the old PS Technique thing where it would project a 35 millimeter image from 35 millimeter lenses and allow, you know, your Canon XL1 to film it. So you'd get 35 millimeter depth of field. So it's a similar thing to that where you're using your phone sensor to record an image off of a screen, but it's giving you kind of an authentic looking, you know, old, very old Polaroid. Like if you go to his Instagram and go to the reels, you'll see you know, like, you know, several of these that he's done, he'll walk you through how it works, what he's doing. And I think it's really cool. You know, would I make a feature film this way? I don't know. Would I use it as kind of the way one might use a lens baby or something to get like a specialty look in for flashbacks or a specific POV, or let's say you needed to recreate the look of an old Polaroid, you know, from, you know, the 1960s or something. This would be great. But also, I think just as a creative tool to make cool, interesting stuff using retro gear, I love it. I think it's really cool.
So it is super cool. I watched the Instagram videos. We'll put a link in the show notes so people can track down Toby's project, which yeah. is super.
And I think that like once ObscuraFlex goes wider, I mean, like right now, I think if you're interested in it, you can send him your email and he'll probably contact you directly. And if it's something that you're interested in trying, you know, you might be able to get him to custom build you one for whatever camera it is that you're talking about. But I think he's going to have like standard kits for certain common cameras that you might be able to find at your, you know, your local pawn shop or whatever. Pawn shop?
Thrift store?
Yeah. Thrift shop. Yeah. I never go to, I don't know that I've ever set foot in a pawn shop in my life, but yeah. Anyway.
Sure.
Except for that time when I really needed money and, you know, I'd given up on my dream of becoming a guitar hero.
I'm pretty sure I went into a pawn shop with you in Vegas when we were shooting Penn & Teller all those years ago. I think we
that is possible. A pawn shop in Vegas seems like just a map of sadness.
It was kind of like the land of broken dreams.
It's like you could like buy golden teeth and glass eyes.
It was definitely an experience to go into a pawn shop in Vegas. So definitely.
If I went, it was for the sheer horror and novelty of it.
Yes, I think that's exactly why we both went. So.
All right, so Ilya, it is your shot. What are you all about this week?
Wow, you know, people talk about having superhero fatigue. I think I'm right there with them. I don't really feel like I need to see another superhero anything. However, super villain, anti-hero is still, I think, a thing that I'm interested in because, you know, I've been looking forward to Joker 2. I just saw the trailer for Joker 2, which is actually called Folie à Deux. So, and I'm not French, so I'll do
that. That means the Madness of Two. And it's actually right. It's a dance move, I believe, or a singing thing.
Well, as I started to Google this to find out what Folie à Deux was, it sounded like it's a Madness of Two. It is there is potentially a mental disorder. I guess it affects more than one person in a family. I guess that's what it is. And of course, in Joker 2, in Folie à Deux, you've got the Joaquin Phoenix character playing the Joker, of course, and you've got Lady Gaga playing Harley Quinn. So then you've got them together and sort of the whole trailer basically looks like they're both crazy. And I gotta say, the new trailer looks really great. So, and Lawrence Shear's back.
Oh,
it's
great.
Like, you know, it's going to be,
he's
it's going to be,
his work is great. And also creator of Shot Deck. Can't say enough good things about Shot Deck.
Yeah. Shot Deck has become an industry tool for sure. You know, it's interesting. I heard a couple people predict that Shot Deck was going to be replaced by AI. Like that was going to be a thing that people would just AI generate all their stuff.
No. Can I tell you right now? I put together very recently a lookbook and I tried to use AI. Firstly, when I showed it to the producer, she was like, get rid of all that AI crap. That all looks like garbage.
Exactly.
I mean, it's like after hours of prompting and pounding away at AI, I got stuff that I was like, yeah, that looks pretty good. And then as soon as it was in there, it was like, lose all that. And, you know, like the only AI thing I could think that Shot Deck could use would be maybe a better AI search for what you're looking for. But already the search on there is excellent. And anyone who's don't mean to go off on a tangent here, but anyone who's putting together a lookbook, a sizzle reel, whatever, do yourself a favor, get yourself an account. I think it's $12 a month, and so if you only need it for one project, that is $12 well spent, and you'll get high resolution, good stills from real movies. And if you're like, hey, I want an over the shoulder shot in the woods of someone, you know, holding a gun, you're going to find a gajillion of those. And it's really, really just one of the best tools out there. Anyway, sorry, don't mean to derail us onto a shot deck.
No, all I'll say is that the Joker 2 trailer, the first real trailer out there that I've seen, Folie à Deux, is available now on YouTube, and we'll put a link in the show notes, and so you can check it out. And of course, it's got moody lighting, it's got psychotic laughter, it's got all the things that you would expect from, you know.
Well, and since we now have a musician, like a woman who makes a living singing and dancing as the partner, because like you don't really think of Joaquin Phoenix as a professional dancer, but there was a lot of dancing in the first Joker movie, and so I can only imagine there will be like full musical numbers now. By the way, I also want to correct myself. Folie à Deux is Madness of Two, and I was thinking of a pas de deux, which is a dance move. And withhold your emails, everybody. I already know I'm an idiot. It's fine, and I don't speak French.
Okay. Well, Ben, I think that just about does it for this episode. Where can people track you down if they want to find
Please track me down at benrock.com. Go there. You'll find all the stuff you need to find. How about yourself, Ilya?
You can find me at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com. It's the camera shop in both Burbank and Portland, Oregon.
All right. Well, Ilya, who do we need to thank this week as opposed to every other week?
Let's start by thanking our new editor, Michael Dispenza. Michael has been coming in and slicing and dicing and chopping these shows together to make it sound like we're not completely dropped on the head. So thank you, Michael.
Does a good job. I'm saying like I'm going to sound like that no matter what I do. So
we got to thank our producer, Alana Cody. Alana, who is scheduling and organizing and pitching and basically booking out all of our interviews for here until the end of time. Thank you.
Until Alana, the end of time, great. Until the heat death of the universe.
Pretty much. Yeah,
it's in her contract. It says
we will still be interviewing people on.
It's like one degree Kelvin. We're almost at no molecular movement. And we're like, what lens did you? And then it gets.
Then
it all goes black and we die.
That's how it's going to work. You already can see the future. Well done, sir. Okay. And then, of course, Kays Alatrachi. Kays, who composed all the music that we use, musicbykays.com. You can hire him to do all kinds of cool stuff, or you can just find him on the social medias and say, hey, man, liked your music. That was great.
Hey,
I'm sure he'd be happy to hear. Sup. Sup.
Yeah, sup, Kays.
All right, Ben. You want to take us out?
Ooh, well, all due respect to Bill Totolo, I'm not saying Seacrest out again. I mean, I guess I just did, but I guess we'll say...
Liar. Liar.
I'm going to go with, that's a wrap. Oh. I'm going to hit stop.
Oh,
no. Wait, do you have something better?
No.
All right.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.